Previously on Beta.
Now look what he's done. Yes, and that fellow will be back any minute.
If someone said to me, what's your favorite soup? I'd say leek and potato.
Nick Danger, Third Eye.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, YouTube star Andrew Ray combines cooking and pop culture with a healthy dollop of fun to create one of the site's most popular channels, Binging with Babish.
I was burning chicken breasts and cookies back in middle school, and I was making home movies to get out of writing essays in middle school. I didn't put the two together for, you know, solid 15, 20 years.
Also, crime novelist Laura Lippman on her mystery Lady in the Lake, which tackles race relations in 1966 Baltimore.
We were a little ways out from the Virginia Slims ads and the Anjali ad where she said she could bring home the bacon and fry it up in a pan.
But first, Steve Gorman. He's the co-founder and drummer of the legacy rock group The Black Crowes. The band topped the charts and dominated the radio airwaves in the early 90s with their bluesy, Rolling Stones-ish swagger, selling over 30 million albums. However, they were also known as much for their dysfunction as for their music. Much of the friction came from the constant fighting between Crowes frontman Chris Robinson and his younger brother Rich. Gorman writes about the band's ups and downs in a memoir called Hard to Handle: The Life and Death of the Black Crowes, where he talks about meeting Chris Robinson for the first time in 1987.
My first impression of him at the time, my immediate thought was that he looked like Emo Phillips, who was at the height of his career, I believe, at that point.
Yeah.
He was just a super skinny, big-nosed, rubber-faced guy with a clear sense of humor and a great wit, which was on display immediately. So we hit it off right away. You know, we had different but complementary senses of humor, if you will. So we found ourselves getting along right from the jump.
Mm-hmm. What did you think the first time you saw the Robinson brothers on stage? What did you think of them?
Chris was, you know, his that manic energy of his, I just couldn't imagine how that translated into someone on stage. Mm. But it did. And in fact, he wasn't performing much as he was standing in place trying desperately to get a point across. And I don't even know if he knew the point. But there was an energy and a very, very real vibe from the minute I saw Mr. Crowes Garden to that singer. Now, his brother, who was playing guitar, had the exact opposite effect. He was invisible and trying to be even more invisible. There was literally no performance value in what he was doing. And he just had his head down and played the songs, and it was workmanlike and completely detached from any passion that his brother might be eliciting from what he was doing. So it was a real dichotomy. You know, it was really good based on, I mean, for my understanding of the world in 1987 and having been in town exactly one day, I thought they were fantastic.
Mm. What was the dynamic between Chris and Rich like?
Like, I mean, not unlike any sets of brothers. I mean, I have brothers myself. I've always known brothers. And you can see a closeness and an intimacy between them that was expressed in ways unlike any I'd ever seen. They were very condescending to each other. They were also very, I mean, nobody else you could not badmouth either one to the other without them defending their brother, but they would destroy each other like clockwork. I mean, they were at each other's throats until someone else got involved, and then they had each other's back. But only until that point would they ever align and show support to the other.
Mm, so that must have made for like a very tense, difficult working relationship, right?
It did. And, you know, in a local band, when you first start, and I knew, you know, it was funny because a few months later when Chris talked to me about joining the band, my first thought was, no way, I'm not getting in between two brothers. That's a suicide mission.
Mm.
And I knew that. And yet I still did it. But for a few years as a local band, we would have blow-ups and we would have arguments and I would get caught in the middle and then I'd be arguing with one or the other of them or both. But in a local band, you do that and then you don't see each other for 3 days.
Mm.
That all ends when you put an album out and tour for, you know, for a year and a half straight. And then that culture finds itself and then suddenly that becomes your new normal.
Baby, try.
So let's talk about putting this album out. The first album you ever drum on is the Black Crowes 1990 hit debut album, Shake Your Moneymaker. What was that like for you?
At the time, it seemed perfectly normal because when you're that age, everything you do, you go, well, yeah, this makes sense. Looking mm-hmm. back now, it's completely absurd. You know, I bought a drum kit in March and less than 3 years later, I had an album in stores. And
yeah.
But the learning curve is so steep when you're young and starting in a band. We had talent. Chris Rich and I all had clearly skills. We didn't know what to do with them. We hadn't developed them yet, but it was all there. The building blocks were in place. We just had to, or they existed. We had to figure out how to put them in place.
Mm.
And I don't know that we ever would have if we hadn't met George Drakoulias, who signed our band and then produced the first two albums. Whatever it was about George that, and we had met other people from other labels before and never felt a single connecting point. With George, it was like he joined the band right off the bat. We all, Chris and Rich and I felt that from that first night.
How are the Robinson Brothers handling all of this success?
We were, the best thing was we were way too busy to spend a whole lot of time thinking about it on the first album. That's an overriding statement for everybody. But with Chris, it was difficult after a while. You know, when you go out and promote an album, he was the guy going into a radio station every day in every city. He's the guy doing every interview. And it was a tremendous workload for someone who's not naturally suited to be charming and on his A game and try to, you know, promotion is not something he was born to do, if you will. He's very good at it when he wants to be. But eventually he really chafed under the scheduling and he just got sick of repeating himself. Mm-hmm. And which I understand.
Yeah.
At the same time, he was very reluctant to share the load because he wanted to be the guy.
Yeah.
Rich, whose skill set is the exact opposite, Rich also wanted to be able to involve himself with that, but he didn't have a natural gift for the gab. He was never very good at that. And again, when I talk about my strengths and weaknesses, more importantly for the band, and I talk about this a lot in the book, the band had inherent great strengths. The band had inherent weaknesses. And by the time our second album was in the can, the biggest flaw in the Black Crowes was we consistently ignored where those lines were. And we forgot what our strengths were. In a desire to do everything, we did a lot of things we probably weren't perfectly suited to do.
Mm. What was your rock and roll bottom with the Black Crowes? Can you point to like a worst moment?
For me personally, it came in Tokyo in 1992, where the everything just finally hit the wall. I thought I couldn't stay in the band anymore. And this is right when our second record was released. I sort of had a breakdown very early. We weren't the kind of band that could talk about how we were feeling on a day-to-day basis. You got up, you put on your armor, and you made sure you didn't turn your back on anybody. You know, it was really like that in that band because the mood could turn against you at any moment.
Yeah.
And again, that becomes familiar. And then in short order, that familiarity becomes comfort.
Mm-hmm.
You get confused. Just because you understand it and recognize it, once you lose sight of the fact that it's not right and shouldn't be that way, but it's more comfortable, then you're dealing with a codependent relationship. Any family with addiction understands this.
She never mentions the word addiction in certain company.
I was having like nightmares, horrific visions at all times. I was really in a bad place. And I looked out my window and I saw that I could actually open it. And I thought, I just want to jump. If I just jump, this would go away. And thankfully, my immediate second thought was, oh my God, what are you doing? And it made me, I threw up. I got sick right there in my room. Like the fact that I admitted to myself that I just had that thought made me physically ill.
Mm.
And so I, you know, and a lot of this was fueled by Chris Robinson and how he was acting and treating everybody. And then, you know, he's dropping a bomb and then everybody else picks it up and dispenses pieces of it without knowing they're doing. You know, the very essence of our band's community was toxic.
Mm-hmm.
And I just couldn't take it anymore. So I went and talked to him about it. And he, We had a long, multi-hour conversation where we aired out everything. And I came away feeling relieved and at least like I'd staved off disaster. And, you know, I don't know how he came away from that, but I know that all those things, nothing, if anything, all I did was I pumped the brakes on the runaway toxicity for myself there, but I don't think I did anybody else any favors because nothing was going to stop that band from careening down the track it was on.
So the band releases some more records and has some more ups and downs. And then in 1999, you play with Led Zeppelin guitar god Jimmy Page. This collaboration leads to the release of a live album and an extensive tour with Jimmy Page in the summer of 2000. What was it like playing with him?
It was the absolute thrill as a musician, but also just as a guy. Jimmy and I got along very well. He was so wonderful and warm and gracious to the band. From the first time we met him in 1995, he was like that. By the time we played shows with him in 99 and 2000, we felt a very, very real kinship. And that experience, it really was great for the Black Crowes internally as well. It was great for the Black Crowes in that our career was really sagging and suddenly the world remembered that we were a good band.
Yeah.
It wasn't as if I were playing with the members of Led Zeppelin. It was my band and all of us doing what we do very comfortably with Jimmy Page added, and that was the best of all worlds.
Yeah, but then the tour with Jimmy Page is suddenly cut short. Why?
Jimmy had a bad back. He had a back situation that he was in a lot of pain, and we were unaware of how bad that was for him. He was really grinning and bearing it for us, and because he was having a good time. And he understand how important this tour was and our association was for the future of the Black Crowes. He was well aware of that. And he was very happy to be providing us with such a lifeline, which is what he was doing. It still struck us as a little odd that it came without warning that the tour was over. We had played the Jay Leno, the Tonight Show with him, walked off stage, and the next night we had a gig down in Orange County, and I walked off the stage at the Tonight Show to my manager telling me, the tour's over, Jimmy's going home. No one ever had any understanding and ever got any information from him again about what happened. And so Pete, our manager, and I, we shared with each other, well, somebody did something must have happened to spur this on. And it wasn't until a year and a half later, and he told me a story, which is detailed in the book quite specifically, that he'd had a conversation with Rich Robinson the night before he left the tour, and that conversation made him question, why am I doing this for these guys? Why am I putting up with so much pain, and why am I risking further damage to my back for a situation where this guy clearly doesn't appreciate me?
Yeah.
And it was a staggering, truly earth-shattering conversation to be on the receiving end of.
How did the Black Crowes finally end?
2015 was going to be the 25th anniversary of our first album, and we thought, let's finish this thing off with a 25th anniversary / farewell tour, and mean it for real. Like, let's go out with the intention of playing 100 or 150 shows to say thank you to everybody that had ever supported the band. And we're leaving now, and we're going to try to go out on a high note. We're going to go out with dignity and with respect for all that we'd accomplished, and most importantly to me, for each other. I really wanted to stand on stage or in a dressing room after the last show and shake hands and hug everyone in the band and say, look, it's not been easy, and we've just been killing each other for years, but let's go out on a high. Let's go out with a good feeling. Okay, we did it. We crossed a finish line. All we have to do is determine where the finish line is, and then we can cross it, and we can all go our separate ways. And Chris Robinson, the singer, decided that would be the time to demand the lion's share of all the money that the band earned. And so he sent an email. His wife wrote an email saying that for him to continue, he suggested I be fired from the band. And then he suggests, but then if I wanted to stay, if Rich decided I needed to be in, then he would offer me a salary for the final tour. And then, so that just left he and his brother. And he wasn't suggesting a 50-50 split. He suggested a 75-25 split.
Wow.
With his own brother.
Wow.
Who he wrote all the songs with.
Wow.
And so, you know, his terms were non-negotiable. And our answer was no. And that was literally the end of the Black Crowes. Then we'll move along. I know this will be awkward, but not for long. 'Cause soon you'll have a new boy to sing you songs. I will not forgive you. No.
Have you heard whether Chris or Rich have read your book? And if they have, do you have any idea what they think of it?
No, I have. I doubt they've read it. And if they did get a copy, they won't read it cover to cover. If they do, I would imagine they'd skim it. They'll hear about what's in it from other people.
Yeah.
I don't think either one of them is going to be at all happy with it. But they would never be happy with it regardless of what I wrote. And what they're going to hate is that someone else now has the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
To a sense. You know, they're losing control of a narrative that's been spun for years, most of which, a great degree of which, was just the flight of fancy of one of them, whichever one was talking at the time. And from my perspective, very rarely rooted in reality.
Yeah. Steve Gorman, thank you very much.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it.
Steve Gorman was the drummer and co-founder of the Black Crowes. He's the author of Hard to Handle, The Life and Death of the Black Crowes. Find out more about Steve at WPR.org/beta.
I do love that omelet scene from the end of Big Night because it's symbolic of the healing and connecting power of food.
YouTube chef Andrew Ray on the power of food in cinema and TV. That's coming up in a minute. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. As far back as Andrew Ray can remember, he's always been passionate about two things, food and film. He combined those two interests to create the hit YouTube series Binging with Babish, which boasts over 5 million subscribers. One of the reasons that Andrew's channel is so popular is that he recreates recipes from movies and TV. For example, the babka from Seinfeld, or Bubba's shrimp gumbo from Forrest Gump, or even the fictitious Krabby Patty from SpongeBob SquarePants. Ray has compiled his favorite recipes into a companion cookbook, also called, yeah, you guessed it, Binging with Babish. Now, combining a foodie audience with a pop culture horde seems like a can't-miss concept. But was that strategy baked in from the start?
I really wish I could say it was a strategy, because if it was, it would be genius. Because I didn't realize that it would create a formula that consistently gets new audience members every time, because it keeps attacking niche subjects and media.
Mm-hmm.
So it just consistently and linearly grows my audience, which is amazing. But just like the channel itself, it was a very happy accident. I just love movies and television. I'm a TV and film junkie. I went to film school. It's always been my shared passion with food. And it also took me 15 years to put those two together. I was, you know, burning chicken breasts and cookies back in middle school, and I was making home movies to get out of writing essays in middle school. I was doing those things at the same time.
Yeah.
I didn't put the two together for, you know, solid 15, 20 years.
Yeah.
And it was very much by accident. I was, you know, I was trying to figure out, you know, what's my cooking show? What kind of thing am I going to cook? It was just going to be a one-off, just a single project. And Parks and Recreation happened to be on in the background. I have TV on the background all the time, just my favorite shows, rewatching them over and over, particularly Frasier.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen every episode of Frasier, I've seen no fewer than 7 times.
Yeah, you hear the tossed salad and scrambled eggs calling all the time.
Oh, big time.
Yeah.
So, you know, Parks and Rec was on in the background, and there was a burger cook-off between Ron Swanson and Chris Traeger.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris's burger was this kind of melange of foodie buzzwords.
I humbly place before you my East Meets West patented Traeger turkey burger, an Asian fusion burger made with Willow Farms organic turkey, a toasted Taleggio cheese crisp, papaya chutney, black truffle aioli, and microgreens on a gluten-free brioche bun.
And, you know, I was like, what would that actually taste like? Were the writers just having fun with foodie buzzwords, or would that actually taste good? And then I realized, okay, you know, maybe this is something that I can try making for this little project. And so just like every other aspect of the channel, it was a very happy accident.
Sure. But did it taste good?
Tasted amazing. It was easily the best turkey burger I've ever had. But being totally honest here, it just wasn't as good as beef. I then made Ron Swanson's burger, which was a simple, like just salt, pepper, hamburger on a bun. And beef just tastes better than turkey, no matter how you dress it up.
Turkey can never beat cow, Chris. Sorry.
So which would you say is your bigger passion, cooking or film?
I think film, honestly. I love cooking, but back in high school, one of my favorite professors had us read a philosophical book about the concept of flow. Yeah. And it's a philosophy I try to live my life by. It's the idea that when you're doing the thing that you're really truly meant for and the thing that you actually derive happiness from, you enter a flow state where
yes.
nothing else exists and you are in your own bubble. And professional musicians and rock climbers and athletes, they all describe a similar thing. But so do factory workers and, you know, people who have just found fulfillment in whatever they're doing in their daily life. And when I'm editing, I enter a flow state. When I'm cooking, I'm kind of stressed out because I'm not as good at it. I'm pretty good at editing. I'll say that confidently. It's my happy place.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. So what about the name? Where does the name Binging with Babish come from?
See, that's proof of the channel's accidental success, is that I named my Reddit handle arbitrarily as a joke after a minor character, an ancillary character from The West Wing, from 8 episodes of The West Wing, portrayed by Oliver Platt. His name is Oliver Babish.
I need a dictaphone.
You've got one on your desk.
Doesn't work.
What's wrong with it?
Doesn't work.
He's asking.
It's stuck on record. It won't stop recording things. So it's just what you want lying around the White House counsel's office, because there's never been a problem with that before.
I'm putting mine in your bag.
And I thought that was funny, so I named my Reddit handle that. And then I was, again, just intending to just make the show once. I was intending to make it for Reddit, for the food subreddit, which is, for those who don't know what that is, it's a place where people can get together and post their pictures of the things that they cooked and discuss it. And I wanted to make a video. I wanted to make a moving picture that I could post there. So I made the show. And I didn't know what to call it, so I just, you know, said, you know, Binging with Babish. You know, I'm Oliver Babish on the subreddit, so I'll be Binging with Babish. And now that not very good and very specific niche joke is my entire brand and identity and what most people think my actual last name is. So
I'll
give you that.
Yeah. Let's talk a bit about the style of Binging with Babish. You have a very slick production that's easy to follow, even though it's condensed and paced for a YouTube audience, but you hardly ever show your face. How did you settle on this aesthetic?
I decided to not show my face very early on, you know, the first episode. The show's changed very little since the first episode.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason I decided not to show my face, at least initially, was because I was seeing a trend on YouTube of cooking shows becoming more vlogs than cooking shows.
Mm.
And so I wanted to make something that was strictly and emphatically focused on the food.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I don't show my face. That's why I wear a black apron so the food pops and so steam pops. And that's why I wanted it to be thoroughly focused on the food. I only started bringing myself into the show, my face and my presence as a person once I was sure that people wanted it.
Yeah. You also use voiceover in every episode, and you're not afraid to poke fun at yourself inside these voiceovers, even though you could simply edit it all away. Why did you decide to take this irreverent approach?
One of the best parts about the advent of YouTube cooking videos, or at least some of them, mine included, is that We're not afraid to show our mistakes, and we're not afraid to show that it gets messy and that things don't go always go correctly. Pepper. Then we're going to lid this up and just pulse it a few times into, oh, it would probably help if we plugged it in, right? And yeah, we're just pulsing this a few times. Oh, what's going on here? Is there something wrong with me? No, my food processor's busted, so let's get out this little hand blender thing. This is going to do just as wonderful a job. It not only makes for better instruction, better technique, because we can show the pitfalls of this recipe and, you know, where you could potentially go wrong and here's how to avoid it, but also shows that it's okay to make mistakes and it's okay to mess up in the kitchen. Traditional cooking shows are wonderful, but they typically are beautiful people in a beautiful kitchen making beautiful food on their first try and making it look like it's just the easiest thing in the world. And that's wonderful. And I like that. I enjoy watching that. But I think that it's more effective and more empowering to the viewer to see that, you know, the host is just like them. We are very capable and frequently make capable of and frequently make gross errors in what we're doing. So I think that it's empowering to be irreverent and self-deprecating in the kitchen.
5 cups chopped porcini mushrooms, 1/2 cup of olive oil, 3 pounds celery.
That is my recipe for wild mushroom.
Yeah, that's right. I got them all. Cold cucumber, corn and crab chowder, mulligatawny.
Mulligatawny?
You're through, soup Nazi. No more soup for you.
You did a whole series of episodes about food from the hit sitcom Seinfeld. As you may or may not know, we here at Beta are huge fans of Seinfeld, but it's not a show that immediately screams foodie. Yet the more you think about it, the more you realize that, hey, yeah, food does play a big role on the show. There's the black and white cookie, the soup Nazi, the marble rye, the calzones, the muffin tops, and the big salads. So Seinfeld actually gave you a wealth of material to riff off of, didn't it?
Big time. I'm sorry I keep saying big time. I'm going to stop
saying it's fine. It's fine. Makes me think of the Peter Gabriel song, Big Time. Maybe we'll put a little bit of Peter Gabriel, Big Time.
All right, well, Big Time.
Big Time, yeah, no, Peter Gabriel.
Yeah, no, Seinfeld, food is absolutely a character in Seinfeld. I mean, the most famous episode, Soup Nazi, like that's a character in and of itself. It's something that's ubiquitous in our culture. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a show about nothing that takes place in New York City. There's going to be food happening always. And I'm hard pressed to think of episodes that feature none at all. Half the time they're in that diner and they're at least talking about it or they're at least eating it in the background. Yeah. And then, there's antique wedding cakes. There's, tricking somebody who keeps a kosher diet into eating lobster. There's tons of examples of food in Seinfeld. Yeah, they definitely gave me a lot to work with, and there's a lot more to explore. And come to think of it, I got to do those lobster eggs. This sounds delicious to me. I want to do some soft scrambled eggs with lobster in them.
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah. A few of the recipes in your book are from the film Chef, which was directed by Jon Favreau. And Jon wrote the foreword to your book. He called Binging with Babish obsessive. How did you connect with Jon?
So I have his kids to thank for getting him into my show, because most of the people watching YouTube are under 30, I would say. I don't know. I don't have stats in front of me, but that seems to be the case. And his kids like forced him to watch it, and then he started watching it. And next thing I know, he's tweeting congratulations when I hit 1 million subscribers. And that was one of the most exciting moments of my life.
Yeah.
Turned out to be only the first of many with him, happily. And after, you know, just knowing that he was aware of the show and knowing that he enjoyed it and enjoyed when I did stuff from his movies, his people said, you know, we're making this show called Chef Show. We'd love for Andrew to come out to L.A. and be on Chef Show. And likewise, John will come on Binging with Babish. Mm-hmm. And yeah, have now have this incredible connection with this Hollywood megastar, who I never could have imagined I would have the opportunity to even be in the same room as, much less have him write a stunning and touching foreword to my book. So that was a superlative and incredible experience. He ended up giving me the carving fork that he used in the movie Chef to make pasta for Scarlett Johansson, because I have a tattoo of it. So
I wanted to ask you about that. Yeah, this is from one of the recipes, pasta Pasta aia olio.
Pasta aia olio.
Yeah, see, I can't do that. I've got this darn Scottish-Canadian accent.
I practice that a lot, don't
yeah,
worry.
Yeah, obviously I have not practiced it enough. But anyway, yeah, tell us about the tattoo.
So I got that tattoo because that episode was particularly important to me. Is because it's the first episode where I realized I would do anything for the show. Because of the evening that I had the idea to make it, again, I'm very impatient, I'm very impulsive, so I had the idea to make it, and I was like, I'm going home, I'm making it tonight. I had the idea at 6, and I was shooting by 8. So yeah, it was like 6 o'clock, and I was leaving work, and the only kitchen supply place that was open that had carving forks was a place called Whisk in Union Square. And I walked down there, and the only carving fork they had was $50. And at the time, I am broker than broke. I am like, you know, $30,000-$40,000 in debt.
Yikes.
And I still bought it because I was like, I'm doing this right.
Nice.
I have to serve it up with a carving fork. And mm-hmm. that was the moment when I realized, you know, I'll do anything for this show. I want to do it right.
Here's a gift for you.
No way. Are
yes,
you
the
me?
Fork from the movie.
I'm getting choked up. That's so amazing.
Well, it's not often that somebody gets a tattoo of something. I mean,
that's incredible.
Let me take a picture so I can buy a replacement for the next guy who comes here. I'll tell him it's the fork, too.
This is
the
640.
This is the yeah.
You've also recreated a lot of fictional food from cartoons and video games. How do you go about doing that?
Well, I mean, happily, those foods are based on foods in real life, so I can make real life approximations mm-hmm. of them. They're also the things that get the most views. My top 3 or 4 most viewed videos are all from cartoons. And I think that's because it's especially exciting. It's exciting to see a piece of your favorite fiction manifested in real life, but it's especially exciting to see a cartoon piece of fiction manifested in real life because, you know, it's much more fantastical. But, you know, Ratatouille from the movie Ratatouille is a real dish called confit bialdi that was developed by Thomas Keller was the culinary consultant on that movie. So he designed that recipe. Szechuan sauce, which set the internet on fire for anybody who's not aware of it, 2 years ago when a cartoon called Rick and Morty featured it heavily in their surprise season premiere.
Welcome to McDonald's. Can I take your order?
Yeah, I'd like to get a 10-piece McNugget and a bunch of the Szechuan sauce, like as much as you're allowed to give me. In 1998, they had this promotion for the Disney film Mulan, where they created a new sauce for the McNuggets called Szechuan sauce, and it's delicious. And then they got rid of it, and now it's gone. This is the only place we're going to be able to try it. It's in my memory.
Rick, you're
and
doing this
was such a craze that it actually prompted McDonald's to reintroduce Szechuan dipping sauce. They touted it as like the best stuff in the world on the cartoon, but it's not very good.
Mm.
And those are not only my most popular episodes, they're also the episodes that gave my show the boost that it needed to really become part of at least the internet mainstream and allowed me to start making an income and make it my full-time job. Mm-hmm. So I owe the show's success to the food from cartoons.
Interesting, yeah. At Beta, we all have our favorite cooking scenes. Our technical director loves the closing omelet scene from Big Night. Our executive producer / showrunner loves the jailhouse feast sequence from Goodfellas. What's your favorite cooking scene in pop culture?
Oh my God, that's tough because I do love that omelet scene from the end of Big Night because it's symbolic of the healing and connecting power of food. It's mm-hmm. it's these two brothers that just had a drunken falling out and they wordlessly make breakfast for each other.
Yeah.
They know that they're going to lose their restaurant. They've lost their relationships. They've lost everything, really. And they've also fought with each other physically and had a huge falling out. And just without saying a word, they silently make breakfast for each other and heal a little bit. And that's the power food can have. So I think that is definitely in my top 3. But my first book, I think I ranked the top food scenes from all time. So I need to stay true to that. And I still think that this is as important. And it's from the movie Chef, where Carl Casper, John Favreau's character, confronts his son when his son tries to serve a burned Cubano sandwich.
Mm.
And he tells him,
"Everything that's good that's happened to me in my life came because of that. I might not do everything great in my life. Okay, I'm not perfect. I'm not the best husband. And I'm sorry if I wasn't the best father. But I'm good at this. And I want to share this with you. I want to teach you what I learned. I get to touch people's lives with what I do. And it keeps me going, and I love it. And I think if you give it a shot, you might love it too. Now, should we have served that sandwich?
No, Chef.
That's my son. Get back in there. We got some hungry people. He's ready to cook.
There's a lot of movies about food, but very few of movies care about them as much as Big Night and Chef. Those two movies really care about food and really want to share it with you, the audience, the same way, and make you feel the same way about it that the characters do.
Yeah.
And make you understand its importance. So that for me is still number one. There isn't even specifically food in that scene. There's a burned sandwich, but it's more about the power of food.
Yeah. Very well said. Yeah. Andrew Ray, thank you for doing Beta with Babish.
I see what you did there. That's good. Thank you so much for having me. It's a lot of fun.
Andrew Ray is the guy behind the hit YouTube series Binging with Babish. His book is called Binging with Babish, 100 Recipes Recreated from Your Favorite Movies and TV Shows. Learn more about what Andrew's cooking up at WPR.org/beta.
I see the crime novel as a particularly good vehicle in writing about certain issues as long as one doesn't become polemical about them.
Crime novelist Laura Lippman talks about her book Lady in the Lake. That's coming up on Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and you're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio.
In the animal kingdom, the male performs to the woman, woos her with his beautiful feathers or flowing mane, is always trying to outstrut the other men. Why do humans do it the other way? It doesn't make sense. Men need us more than we need them. You were in the minority that day. You were in an our neighborhood, and almost everyone else there would have picked me. Younger, taller, shapelier me. Maybe even your husband, Milton.
That's crime novelist Laura Lippman reading a short excerpt from her book, Lady in the Lake. Laura's been named one of the most essential crime writers of the past 100 years. In her book, she combines elements of noir with an exploration of social issues like race, gender, and religion. The novel's set in Baltimore in 1966. Laura shares why she settled on this particular year.
I felt that so much of the fiction I had read about the 60s tended to focus on a couple of years, maybe 63, the assassination of John Kennedy, which was such a huge scar on the national psyche. Or people tended to write about the late 60s when huge things happened again, where there seemed to be these great upheavals. 66 is an interesting kind of hinge year. Things are changing. There's a lot of stuff bubbling beneath the surface. But in many ways, the old order is holding on by its fingernails. I found this terrific book called 1966, which is a history of the year through its pop singles. And one of the key facts you find out when you read the book is that it's a year in the United States where Roger Miller had a number one song with King of the Road, and the Rolling Stones had a number one song with Satisfaction. And I thought, that's it. That's a time period. That's a culture that's really breaking apart, and that's interesting to me.
Mm. And also, I've read that you wanted to write a novel about a woman who wanted to matter, and this was a story that was very much of that time period.
It is. It was a time in which no one would have spoken about women having it all. That wasn't a concept yet. We were a little ways out from the Virginia Slims ads and the Anjali ad where she said she could bring home the bacon and fry it up in a pan, that whole thing.
Yeah.
It was a time when there were a lot of women kind of quietly heading into the workforce. That did seem to me to be a key element of that era, of women beginning to look around and say, what if I wanted something more? And especially a woman like Maddie in Lady in the Lake, who has a son who's about to head to college, and a husband who, young as he is already talking about retirement. And there's a line early in the book where he asks Maddie, well, how do you feel about the Atlantic side of Florida versus the Gulf side? And she wonders, those are my choices now? That's all I get to decide is whether I'm going to retire in Boca or Sarasota? And I think that really sparks something in her because she's only 37 years old.
Yeah. Can you give us a brief outline of the storyline of Lady in the Lake without revealing any spoilers?
Sure, I think I can. Lady in the Lake is about a woman named Maddie Morgenstern Schwartz, who believes herself to be contented. She has a good marriage. She has a teenage son. Her life is just humming along. And she doesn't think to question anything until she has a chance encounter with an old high school classmate who indirectly, not meaning to, reminds her of all the promises that she made her young self. She saw herself as an intellectual. She saw herself as someone who was going to write, someone who was going to have an exciting, original life. And she broke all those promises to herself. And within weeks of that chance encounter, she's left her husband. She's moved into a new apartment. She's struggling to get by. And she has a really unexpected discovery that leads her to think, you know what? I could be a newspaper reporter, and I'm going to try to be that. And she tries, but what she finds out is that the newspaper only sees her as someone who could possibly be a clerical assistant, mm-hmm. a secretary, never a reporter. So she has to find a story that's small enough that they'll let her work on it, but potentially big enough that it will impress people if she breaks it open. And she focuses on the death of an African-American woman whose body has been found in the fountain in the lake at a public park after a disappearance of many months that the daily newspapers have never acknowledged, in part because she is an African-American woman and there's very little interest.
The two murders that figure prominently in your novel, they're based on real crimes, right?
Yes. They're based on crimes that happened in 1969, and I made, again, the decision that, no, I wanted to write about 66, and I would repurpose those deaths for my book. In 1969, a woman named Shirley Parker was, in fact, discovered in the fountain at Druid Hill Park in Baltimore. And to this day, that remains an unsolved death. They couldn't even classify it as a homicide because they couldn't determine the cause of death by the time they found the body. The same year, a little girl, an 11-year-old girl, disappeared and was quickly found, and she had been murdered. And that case was solved very quickly. And as a kid growing up in Baltimore, it was a case I knew and was familiar with. I didn't find out about the so-called Lady in the Lake until I went to work at the Baltimore Sun, where it was a story that was sometimes written about as a local curiosity, an unsolved murder. And I was struck mostly by the fact that an 11-year-old girl had died, and I knew everything about that. I knew it contemporaneously. And a woman had died, and I knew nothing about it, and I had never even read about it.
So that was kind of like the driving force, kind of inspired the novel, I guess. Would that be fair to say?
I think it is fair to say. And then the trick was, how does one tie those two things together when they're not connected? And I'm a crime novelist, and very proudly so, but I'm not the kind of crime novelist who's going to write a story in which there's some vast conspiracy involving all the higher-ups in a city that are somehow going to link these two deaths. That's just not of interest to me. I like to work a little bit closer to the ground. I like to tell stories that feel real and not overly dramatized. So I wanted to find a different way to link those two stories, and that was Maddie. Maddie is interested in the first death, and she's interested in the second, and she's the only connection
How did your experience as a journalist influence the way you approached writing Lady in the Lake?
Women Maddie's age would have been my colleagues and mentors. I knew their stories. Mm-hmm. I knew a lot about what had happened to them. And I think especially in newsrooms, they were pretty raucous, careless places. You know, they certainly wouldn't begin to be considered appropriate in today's environment.
Yeah.
But they probably shouldn't have been considered appropriate in their time.
Yeah.
They were pretty sexist. They tended to be very gendered in the idea of who could do what job, who covered what beat. And I was surrounded by some pretty hard-charging women who were determined to change those ideas, but it wasn't always easy.
Yeah. You cover a lot of different issues throughout your novel, gender, race, and religion. How important was it to you to explore social issues in Lady in the Lake?
It's always important to me to explore social issues. One of my favorite novelists is Dreiser.
Mm.
And the social novel, which comes in and out of vogue within literary fiction, has always been very important to crime fiction. And when I started writing crime fiction in the 1990s, there was a sense that certain topics, the focus on what it meant to live in a particular city and its problems, class issues, economic inequality, all of those things were kind of on the table at the time for crime writers to write about. No one seemed to be that interested. Money is so central to so many crime novels that it allows us to write about class and economic inequality in a way that wasn't always being taken advantage of in literary fiction. I think literary fiction has swung back around
mm-hmm.
and is more interested in the social novel.
Yeah.
I read a lot of literary fiction. I'm, you know, a huge fan of all fiction. But I see the crime novel as a particularly good vehicle for writing about the times we live in now and writing about certain issues as long as one doesn't become polemical about them.
How much have the racial dynamics in 1960s Baltimore, when your book is set, how much have they changed over the past 50 years?
Well, that is a very big and complicated question. I've been doing some research that has nothing to do with my novels, but has to do with a book of essays that I've been asked to write. And I know that by the 60s, Baltimore City had become a majority African-American school district, which would seem to indicate that the city as well had become majority African-American. So that's the history of Baltimore, that it has long had a minority-majority population, and it has been very reluctant to grant power to that population. It was a long time before we had an African-American mayor. And even now, with the politicians of the city more and more looking like the people that they represent, it's still a city that is full of so many haves and have-nots. This is a city that is not providing enough opportunities for the people who really need them.
Has writing Lady in the Lake changed the way you think about Baltimore in any way?
No. No, I mean, I live in Baltimore. My life is intertwined with Baltimore. I'm very much of the city. Lady in the Lake didn't change my relationship with Baltimore. I think it changed me a lot as a writer.
How so?
It was an unusual book in which I decided that I wasn't going to just tell the story of the living woman and the dead woman, but that I was going to try in these tiny little chapters to tell the story of almost every person who shows up in the book. And, you know, I decided in writing this book that I was going to write these like 18 little micro profiles within
yeah.
the book.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite things about the book, because I loved how you'd introduce like a character like the little man and the bartender, and then in the very next chapter we'd have these little micro profiles. It was great. It was so well done, and it really sort of added a depth, an extra depth and layer to your story.
Well, thank you. And I've been asked a lot since I wrote the book, where did you get that idea and how did you know you were going to do it and when did you realize it was going to work? And my answer has consistently been, I don't have a clue. I don't know where that idea came from. I don't know why I thought I could pull it off. I was really adamant about it. And it's made me even more ambitious. I never lacked for ambition. I never will. But this one took it up a notch, and I find myself working on my next book and saying, how am I going to challenge myself? How am I going to challenge the form? What am I going to do in this book that I've never done before? And those are really important questions to me.
Laura Lippman, thank you very much.
Hey, thank you. This is a pleasure.
Laura Lippman is the author of Lady in the Lake. You can find out more about Laura at WPR.org/beta. That does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Steve Gorman, Andrew Ray, and Laura Lippman. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta podcast via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
Can't help it that I'm size for love.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
Seems to me this silly son of a bitch already forked over, big time.
And thanks to you, our alphas. Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
Look, I am 96% sure that you are the guy, so why don't you just, like, admit it?